I could use magic to sound out your mind, but it's exhausting. Besides, I like seeing people's eyes pop out of their sockets from pain. And you're going to tell me anyway. Dandelion knew he would. The rope, secured to his ankles, grew taut. The bucket of lime scraped along the ground.
"Sir,"
said the first ruffian suddenly, covering the lantern with his cloak and peering through the gap in the pigsty door.
"Someone's coming. A lass, I think." "You know what to do," Ryons hissed. "Put the lantern out."
The reeking man released the rope, and Dandelion tumbled inertly to the ground, falling in such a way that he could see the man with the lantern standing at the door, and the reeking man, a long knife in his hand, lying in wait on the other side. Light broke in from the bawdy house through gaps in the planks, and the poet heard the singing and hubbub. The door to the pigsty creaked open, revealing a short figure wrapped in a cloak and wearing a round, tightly fitting cap. After a moment's hesitation, the woman crossed the threshold. The reeking man threw himself at her, slashing forcefully with his knife, and tumbled to his knees as the knife met with no resistance, passing through the figure's throat as though through a cloud of smoke. Because the figure really was a cloud of smoke, one which was already starting to disperse. But before it completely vanished, another figure burst into the pigsty, indistinct, dark, and nimble as a weasel. Dandelion saw it throw a cloak at the lantern man, jump over the reeking one, saw something glisten in its hand, and heard the reeking man wheeze and choke savagely. The lantern man disentangled himself from the cloak, jumped, took a swing with his knife. A fiery lightning bolt shot from the dark figure with a hiss, slapped over the tough's face and chest with a crack, and spread over him like flaming oil. The ruffian screamed piercingly, and the grim reek of burning meat filled the pigsty. Then Ryons attacked. The spell he cast illuminated the darkness with a bluish flash, in which Dandelion saw a slender woman wearing man's clothes, gesticulating strangely with both hands. He only glimpsed her for a second, before the blue glow disappeared with a bang and a blinding flash. Ryons fell back with a roar of fury and collapsed onto the wooden pigsty walls, breaking them with a crash. The woman, dressed in man's clothing, leapt after him, a stiletto flashing in her hand. The pigsty filled with brightness again, this time golden, beaming from a bright oval which suddenly appeared in the air. Dandelion saw Ryons spring up from the dusty floor, leap into the oval, and immediately disappear. The oval dimmed, but before it went out entirely, the woman ran up to it, shouting incomprehensibly, stretching out her hand. Something crackled and rustled, and the dying oval boiled with roaring flames for a moment. A muffled sound, as if coming from a great distance, reached Dandelion's ears. A sound very much like a scream of pain. The oval went out completely, and darkness engulfed the pigsty again. The poet felt the power which gagged him disappear.
"Help!" he howled. "Help!"
"Stop yelling, Dandelion," said the woman, kneeling next to him, and slicing through the knots with Ryons's stiletto.
"Yennefer? Is that you?"
"Surely you're not going to say you don't remember how I look, and I'm sure my voice is not unfamiliar to your musical ear. Can you get up? They didn't break any bones, did they?" Dandelion stood with difficulty, groaned and stretched his aching shoulders.
"What's with them?"
He indicated the bodies lying on the ground. "We'll check." The enchantress snicked the stiletto shut. "One of them should still be alive. I have a few questions for him."
"This one?"
The troubadour stood over the reeking man.
"Probably still lives."
"I doubt it," said Yennefer indifferently. "I severed his windpipe and carotid artery. There might still be a little murmur in him, but not for long." Dandelion shuddered.
"You slashed his throat." "If, out of inborn caution, I hadn't sent an illusion in first, I would be the one lying there now. Let's look at the other one." "Bloody hell. Such a sturdy fellow, and he still couldn't take it." "Pity, pity. He's dead too. He couldn't take the shock. I fried him a little too hard. See, even his teeth are charred. What's the matter with you, Dandelion? Are you going to be sick?"
"I am,"
the poet replied indistinctly, bending over and leaning his forehead against the pigsty wall.
"That's everything?"
The enchantress put her tumbler down and reached for the skewer of roast chickens.
"You haven't lied about anything, haven't forgotten anything?"
"Nothing, apart from thank you. Thank you, Yennefer."
She looked him in the eyes and nodded her head lightly, making her glistening black curls writhe and cascade down to her shoulders. She slipped the roast chicken onto a trencher and began dividing it skillfully. She used a knife and fork. Dandelion had only known one person up until then who could eat a chicken with a knife and fork as skillfully. Now he knew how and from whom Geralt had learnt the knack.
Well, he thought, no wonder. After all, he did live with her for a year in Vengerberg, and before he left her, she had instilled a number of strange things into him.
He pulled the other chicken from the skewer, and without a second thought, ripped off a thigh and began eating it, pointedly holding it with both hands.
"How did you know?" he asked. "How did you arrive with help on time?"
"I was beneath Bleoveris during a performance."
"I didn't see you."
"I didn't want to be seen. Then I followed you into town. I waited here in the tavern. It wasn't fitting, after all, for me to follow you into that haven of dubious delight and certain gonorrhea. But I eventually became impatient and was wandering around the yard when I thought I heard voices coming from the pigsty. I sharpened my hearing, and it turned out it wasn't, as I'd first thought, some sodomite, but you."
"Hey, innkeeper, more wine, if you please. At your command, honoured lady. Quick as a flash. The same as before, please, but this time without the water. I can only tolerate water in a bath. In wine, I find it quite loathsome. At your service. At your service."
Yennefer pushed her plate aside. There was still enough meat on the chicken, Dandelion noticed, to feed the innkeeper and his family for breakfast. A knife and fork were certainly elegant and refined, but they weren't very effective.
"Thank you," he repeated, "for rescuing me. That cursed Ryonce wouldn't have spared my life. He'd have squeezed everything from me and then butchered me like a sheep."
"Yes, I think he would."
She poured herself in the bard some wine, then raised her tumbler.
"So, let's drink to your rescue and health, Dandelion."
"And to yours, Yennefer," he toasted her in return.
"To health, for which, as of today, I shall pray whenever the occasion arises. I'm indebted to you, beautiful lady, and I shall repay the debt in my songs. I shall explode the myth which claims wizards are insensitive to the pain of others, that they are rarely eager to help poor, unfortunate, unfamiliar mortals."
"What to do?"
She smiled, half-shutting her beautiful violet eyes.
"The myth has some justification. It did not spring from nowhere. But you're not a stranger, Dandelion. I know you, and like you."
"Really?"
The poet smiled too. "You've been good at concealing it up until now. I've even heard the rumour that you can't stand me. I quote, any more than the plague."
"It was the case once."
The enchantress suddenly grew serious.
"Later my opinion changed. Later, I was grateful to you."
"What for, if I may ask?"
"Never mind," she said, toying with the empty tumbler. "Let us get back to more important questions. Those you were asked in the pigsty while your arms were being twisted out of their sockets. What really happened, Dandelion? Have you really not seen Geralt since you fled the banks of the Yaruga? Did you really not know he returned south after the war? That he was seriously wounded? So seriously, there were even rumours of his death. Didn't you know anything?"
"No, I didn't. I stayed in Pont Varnis for a long time, in Esterad Thyssen's court, and then at Nidamir's in Hengfors."
"You didn't know?"
The enchantress nodded and unfastened her tunic. A black velvet ribbon wound around her neck, an obsidian star set with diamonds hanging from it.
"You didn't know that when his wounds healed, Geralt went to Trance River? You can't guess who he was looking for?"
"That I can, but I don't know if he found her."
"You don't know," she repeated. "You, who usually know everything, and then sing about everything, even such intimate matters as someone else's feelings? I listened to your ballads beneath Bleoveris, Dandelion. You dedicated a good few verses to me."
"Poetry," he muttered, staring at the chicken, "has its rights. No one should be offended.
Hair like a raven's wing, as a storm in the night," quoted Yennefer with exaggerated emphasis. "And in the violet eyes sleep lightning bolts. Isn't that how it went?"
"That's how I remembered you."
The poet smiled faintly.
"May the first who wishes to claim the description as untrue throw the first stone."
"Only I don't know."
The enchantress pinched her lips together. "Who gave you permission to describe my internal organs?
How did it go? Her heart as though a jewel adorned her neck? Hard as if of diamond made, and as a diamond so unfeeling. Sharper than obsidian cutting. Did you make that up yourself? Or perhaps..."
Her lips quivered, twisted,
Or perhaps you listened to someone's confidences and grievances.
Dandelion cleared his throat and veered away from the dangerous subject.
Tell me, Yennefer, when did you last see Geralt?
A long time ago.
After the war?
After the war.
Yennefer's voice changed a little.
No. I never saw him after the war. For a long time, I didn't see anybody.
Well, back to the point, poet. I am a little surprised to discover that you do not know anything, you have not heard anything, and that in spite of this, someone searching for information picked you out to stretch over a beam. Doesn't that worry you?
It does.
Listen to me, she said sharply, banging her tumbler against the table. Listen carefully. Strike that ballad from your repertoire. Do not sing it again. Are you talking about... You know perfectly well what I'm talking about. Sing about the war against Nilfgaard. Sing about Geralt and me. You'll neither harm nor help anyone in the process. You'll make nothing any better or worse. But do not sing about the lion cub of Sintra.
She glanced around to check if any of the few customers at this hour were eavesdropping, and waited until the lass, clearing up, had returned to the kitchen.
And do try to avoid one-to-one meetings with people you don't know, she said quietly.
People who forget to introduce themselves by conveying greetings from a mutual acquaintance. Understand? He looked at her surprised. Yennefer smiled.
Greetings from Dykstra, Dandelion.
Now the bard glanced around timidly. His astonishment must have been evident, and his expression amusing, because the sorceress allowed herself a quite derisive grimace.
While we are on the subject, she whispered, leaning across the table, Dykstra is asking for a report. You're on your way back from Verden, and he's interested in hearing what's being said at King Erville's court. He asked me to convey that this time your report should be to the point, detailed, and under no circumstances in verse. Prose, Dandelion. Prose.
The poet swallowed and nodded. He remained silent, pondering the question. But the enchantress anticipated him.
Difficult times are approaching, she said quietly. Difficult and dangerous. A time of change is coming. It would be a shame to grow old with the uncomfortable conviction that one had done nothing to ensure that these changes are for the better. Don't you agree?
He agreed with a nod and cleared his throat.
Yennefer, I'm listening, poet.
Those men in the pigsty. I would like to know who they were, what they wanted, who sent them. You killed them both. But rumour has it that you can draw information even from the dead. And doesn't rumour also have it that necromancy is forbidden by edict of the chapter? Let it go, Dandelion. Those thugs probably didn't know much anyway. The one who escaped... he's another matter.
Ryons? He was a wizard, wasn't he?
Yes, but not a very proficient one.
Yet he managed to escape from you. I saw how he did it. He teleported, didn't he? Doesn't that prove anything?
Indeed it does. That someone helped him.
Ryons had neither the time nor the strength to open an oval portal suspended in the air. A portal like that is no joke. It's clear that someone else opened it. Someone far more powerful.
That's why I was afraid to chase him, not knowing where I would land. But I sent some pretty hot stuff after him. He's going to need a lot of spells and some effective burn elixirs, and will remain marked for some time.
Maybe you will be interested to hear that he was a Nilfgaardian.
You think so?
Yennefer sat up, and with a swift movement pulled the stiletto from her pocket and turned it in her palm.
A lot of people carry Nilfgaardian knives now. They're comfortable and handy. They can even be hidden in a cleavage. It's not the knife. When he was questioning me, he used the term battle for Sintra, conquest of the town, or something along those lines. I've never heard anyone describe those events like that. For us, it has always been a massacre. The massacre of Sintra. No one refers to it by any other name.
The magician raised her hand, scrutinized her nails.
Clever, Dandelion. You have a sensitive ear.
It's a professional hazard.
I wonder which profession you have in mind.
She smiled coquettishly.
But thank you for the information. It was valuable.
"Let it be," he replied with a smile, "my contribution to making changes for the better. Tell me, Yennefer, why is Nilfgaard so interested in Geralt and the girl from Sintra? Don't stick your nose into that business." She suddenly turned serious. "I said you were to forget you ever heard of Calanthe's granddaughter."
"Indeed you did. But I'm not searching for a subject for a ballad.
What the hell are you searching for, then? Trouble?"
"Let's take it," he said quietly, resting his chin on his clasped hands and looking the enchantress in the eye. "Let's take it that Geralt did, in fact, find and rescue the child. Let's take it that he finally came to believe in the power of destiny and took the child with him. Where to? Rhyonce tried to force it out of me with torture. But you know, Yennefer, you know where the Witcher is hiding."
"I do."
"And you know how to get there."
"I know that too."
"Don't you think he should be warned? Warned that the likes of Rhyonce are looking for him, and the little girl? I would go, but I honestly don't know where it is. That place whose name I prefer not to say."
"Get to the point, Dandelion.
If you know where Geralt is, you ought to go and warn him. You owe him that, Yennefer. There was, after all, something between you."
"Yes," she acknowledged coldly. "There was something between us. That's why I know him a bit. He does not like having help imposed on him, and if he was in need of it, he would seek it from those he could trust. A year has gone by since those events, and I've not had any news from him, and as for our debt, I owe him exactly as much as he owes me, no more and no less."
"So I'll go then." He raised his head high.
"Tell me."
"I won't," she interrupted.
"Your cover's blown, Dandelion. They might come after you again. The less you know, the better. Banish from here. Go to Redania, to Dykstra and Philippa Eilhart. Stick to Vizhimir's court. And I warn you once more, forget the lion cub of Sintra. Forget about Ciri. Pretend you have never heard the name. Do as I ask. I wouldn't like anything bad to happen to you. I like you too much. Owe you too much."
"You've said that already. What do you owe me, Yennefer?"
The sorceress turned her head away, did not say anything for a while. "You travelled with him," she said finally. "Thanks to you, he was not alone. You were a friend to him. You were with him."
The bard lowered his eyes. "He didn't get much from it," he muttered. "He didn't get much from our friendship. He had little but trouble because of me. He constantly had to get me out of some scrape. Help me."
She leaned across the table, put her hand on his and squeezed it, hard, without saying anything. Her eyes held regret. "Go to Redania," she repeated after a moment. "To Traitorgore. Stay in Dykstra's and Philippa's care. Don't play at being a hero. You have got yourself mixed up in a dangerous affair, Dandelion."
"I've noticed."
He grimaced and rubbed his aching shoulder.
"And that is precisely why I believe Geralt should be warned. You are the only one who knows where to look for him. You know the way. I guess you used to be a guest there?"
Yennefer turned away. Dandelion saw her lips pinch, the muscles in her cheek quiver.
"Yes, in the past," she said,
and there was something elusive and strange in her voice.
"I used to be a guest there, sometimes, but never uninvited."
The wind howled savagely, rippling through the grasses growing over the ruins, rustling in the hawthorn bushes and tall nettles. Clouds sped across the sphere of the moon, momentarily illuminating the great castle, drenching the moat and few remaining walls in a pale glow, undulating with shadows, and revealing mounds of skulls baring their broken teeth and staring into nothingness through the black holes of their eye sockets. Ciri squealed sharply and hid her face in the witch's cloak. The mare, prodded on by the witch's heels, carefully stepped over a pile of bricks and passed through the broken arcade. Her horseshoes, ringing against the flagstones, awoke weird echoes between the walls, muffled by the howling gale. Ciri trembled, digging her hands into the horse's mane.
"I'm frightened," she whispered.
"There's nothing to be frightened of,"
replied the Witcher, laying his hand on her shoulder. It's hard to find a safer place in the whole world. This is Caer Morhen, the Witcher's Keep. There used to be a beautiful castle here, a long time ago. She did not reply, bowing her head low. The Witcher's mare, called Roach, snorted quietly, as if she too wanted to reassure the girl. They immersed themselves in a dark abyss, in a long, unending black tunnel, dotted with columns and arcades. Roach stepped confidently and willingly, ignoring the impenetrable darkness, and her horseshoes rang brightly against the floor. In front of them, at the end of the tunnel, a straight, vertical line suddenly flared with a red light. Growing taller and wider, it became a door beyond which was a faint glow, the flickering brightness of torches stuck in iron mounts on the walls. A black figure stood framed in the door, blurred by the brightness.
"Who comes?"
Ciri heard a menacing, metallic voice, which sounded like a dog's bark.
"Geralt?"
"Yes, Eskel. It's me.
Come in."
The Witcher dismounted, took Ciri from the saddle, stood her on the ground, and pressed a bundle into her little hands, which she grabbed tightly, only regretting that it was too small for her to hide behind completely.
"Wait here with Eskel," he said. "I'll take Roach to the stables."
"Come into the light, laddie," growled the man called Eskel. "Don't lurk in the dark."
Ciri looked up into his face and barely restrained her frightened scream. He wasn't human. Although he stood on two legs, although he smelled of sweat and smoke, although he wore ordinary human clothes, he was not human.
"No human can have a face like that," she thought.
"Well, what are you waiting for?"
repeated Eskel. She didn't move. In the darkness, she heard the clatter of Roach's horseshoes grow fainter. Something soft and squeaking ran over her foot. She jumped.
"Don't loiter in the dark, or the rats will eat your boots."
Still clinging to her bundle, Ciri moved briskly towards the light. The rats bolted out from beneath her feet with a squeak. Eskil leaned over, took the package from her, and pulled back her hood.
"A plague on it," he muttered.
"A girl. That's all we need."
She glanced at him, frightened. Eskil was smiling. She saw that he was human after all, that he had an entirely human face, deformed by a long, ugly, semicircular scar running from the corner of his mouth, across the length of his cheek, up to the ear.
"Since you're here, welcome to Caer Morhen," he said. "What do they call you?"
"Ciri,"
Geralt replied for her, silently emerging from the darkness. Eskil turned around. Suddenly, quickly, wordlessly, the witchers fell into each other's arms and wound their shoulders around each other tight and hard for one brief moment.
"Wolf, you're alive."
"I am."
"All right."
Eskil took a torch from his bracket.
"Come on. I'm closing the inner gates to stop the heat escaping."
They walked along the corridor. There were rats here, too. They flitted under the walls, squeaked from the dark abyss, from the branching passages, and skittered before the swaying circle of light thrown by the torch. Ciri walked quickly, trying to keep up with the men.
"Who's wintering here, Eskil, apart from Vesemir?"
"Lambert and Cohen."
They descended a steep and slippery flight of stairs. A gleam was visible below them. Ciri heard voices, detected the smell of smoke. The hall was enormous and flooded with light from a huge hearth roaring with flames, which were being sucked up into the heart of the chimney. The centre of the hall was taken up by an enormous heavy table. At least 10 people could sit around that table. There were three. Three humans. Three witches, Ciri corrected herself. She saw nothing but their silhouettes against the fire in the hearth.
"Greetings, Wolf. We've been waiting for you."
"Greetings, Vesemir. Greetings, lad. It's good to be home again."
"Who have you brought us?"
Geralt was silent for a moment. Then he put his hand on Ciri's shoulder and lightly pushed her forward. She walked awkwardly, hesitantly, huddled up and hunched, her head lowered.
"I'm frightened," she thought. "I'm very frightened. When Geralt found me, when he took me with him, I thought the fear wouldn't come back. I thought it had passed. And now, instead of being at home, I'm in this terrible, dark, ruined old castle full of rats and dreadful echoes. I'm standing in front of a red wall of fire again, I see sinister black figures. I see dreadful, menacing, glistening eyes staring at me.
Who is this child, Wolf? Who is this girl? She's my...
Geralt suddenly stammered. She felt his strong, hard hands on her shoulders. And suddenly, the fear disappeared, vanished without a trace. The roaring red fire gave out warmth, only warmth. The black silhouettes were the silhouettes of friends, carers. Their glistening eyes expressed curiosity, concern, and unease. Geralt's hands clenched over her shoulders.
She's our destiny.
Verily, there is nothing so hideous as the monsters, so contrary to nature, known as witches, for they are the offspring of foul sorcery and devilry. They are rogues without virtue, conscience, or scruple, true diabolic creations, fit only for killing. There is no place amidst honest men for such as they. And Caer Morhen, where these infamous beings nestle, where they perform their foul practices, must be wiped from the surface of this earth, and all trace of it strewn with salt and saltpeter.
Anonymous, Monstrum, or Description of the Witcher. Intolerance and superstition has always been the domain of the more stupid amongst the common folk, and, I conjecture, will never be uprooted, for they are as eternal as stupidity itself. There, where mountains tower today, one day there will be seas. There, where today seas surge, will one day be deserts. But stupidity will remain stupidity. Nicodemus de Boot, Meditations on Life, Happiness, and Prosperity. Chapter 2. Triss Merigold blew into her frozen hands, wriggled her fingers, and murmured a magic formula. Her horse, a gelding, immediately reacted to the spell, snorting and turning its head, looking at the enchantress with eyes made watery by the cold and wind.
"You've got two options, old thing," said Triss, pulling on her gloves. "Either you get used to magic, or I sell you to some peasants to pull a plough."
The gelding pricked up its ears, snorted vapour through its nostrils, and obediently started down the wooded mountainside. The magician leaned over in the saddle, avoiding being lashed by the frosty branches. The magic worked quickly. She stopped feeling the sting of cold in her elbows and on her neck, and the unpleasant sensation of cold which had made her hunch her shoulders and draw her head in disappeared. The spell, warming her, also muffled the hunger which had been eating at her for several hours. Triss cheered up, made herself comfortable in the saddle, and, with greater attention than before, started to take stock of her surroundings. Ever since she had left the beaten track, she had been guided by the greyish-white wall of mountains and their snow-capped summits, which glistened gold in those rare moments when the sun pierced the clouds, usually in the morning or just before sunset. Now that she was closer to the mountain chain, she had to take greater care. The land around Caer Morhen was famous for its wildness and inaccessibility, and the gap in the granite wall that was a vital landmark was not easy for an inexperienced eye to find. It was enough to turn down one of the numerous gullies and gorges to lose sight of it, and even she, who knew the land, knew the way, and knew where to look for the pass, could not allow herself to lose her concentration for an instant. The forest came to an end. A wide valley opened before the enchantress, strewn with boulders which ran across the valley to the sheer mountain slope on the other side. The Gwentlech, the river of white stones, flowed down the heart of the valley, foam, seething between the boulders and logs, washed along by the current. Here, in its upper reaches, the Gwentlech was no more than a wide but shallow stream. Up here, it could be crossed without any difficulty. Lower down, in Caedwen, in its middle reaches, the river was an insurmountable obstacle, rushing and breaking against the beds of its steep chasms. The gelding, driven into the water, hastened its step, clearly wanting to reach the opposite bank as quickly as possible. Triss held it back lightly. The stream was shallow, reaching just above the horse's fetlocks, but the pebbles covering the bed were slippery, and the current was sharp and quick. The water churned and foamed around her mount's legs. The magician looked up at the sky. The growing cold and increasing wind here in the mountains could herald a blizzard, and she did not find the prospect of spending yet another night in a grotto or rocky nook too attractive. She could, if she had to, continue her journey even through a blizzard. She could locate the path using telepathy. She could, using magic, make herself insensitive to the cold. She could, if she had to. But she preferred not to have to. Luckily, Caer Morhen was already close. Triss urged the gelding onto flat scree, over an enormous heap of stones washed down by glaciers and streams, and rode into a narrow pass between rocky outcrops. The gorge walls rose vertically, and seemed to meet high above her, only divided by a narrow line of sky. It grew warmer. The wind, howling above the rocks, could no longer reach to lash and sting at her. The pass broadened, leading through a ravine, and then into the valley, opening onto a huge depression, covered by forest, which stretched out amidst jagged boulders. The magician ignored the gentle, accessible depression rim, and rode down towards the forest, into the thick backwoods. Dry branches cracked under the gelding's hooves. Forced to step over fallen tree trunks, the horse snorted, danced, and stamped. Triss pulled at the reins, tugged at her mount's shaggy ear, and scolded it harshly with spiteful allusions to its lameness. The steed, looking for all the world as though it were ashamed of itself, walked with a more even and sprightly gait, and picked its way through the thicket. Before long, they emerged onto clearer land, riding along the trough of a stream which barely trickled along the ravine bed. The magician looked around carefully, finally finding what she was looking for. Over the gully, supported horizontally by enormous boulders, lay a mighty tree trunk, dark, bare, and turning green with moss. Triss rode closer, wanting to make sure this was, indeed, the trail, and not a tree accidentally felled in a gale. But she spied a narrow, indistinct pathway disappearing into the woods. She could not be mistaken. This was definitely the trail, a path encircling the old castle of Caer Morhen, and beset with obstacles, where witches trained to improve their running speeds and controlled breathing. The path was known as the trail, but Triss knew young witches had given it their own name, the killer. She clung to the horse's neck and slowly rode under the trunk. At that moment, she heard stones grating and the fast, light footsteps of someone running. She turned in her saddle, pulled on the reins, and waited for the witcher to run out onto the log. A witcher did run out onto the log, flitted along it like an arrow without slowing down, without even using his arms to aid his balance, running nimbly, fluently, with incredible grace. He flashed by, approaching and disappearing amongst the trees without disturbing a single branch. Triss sighed loudly, shaking her head in disbelief, because the witcher, judging by his height and build, was only about 12. The magician eased the reins, nudged the horse with her heels, and trotted upstream. She knew the trail cut across the ravine once more, at a spot known as the Gullet. She wanted to catch a glimpse of the little witcher once again. Children had not been trained in Caer Morhen for near to a quarter of a century. She was not in a great hurry. The narrow killer path meandered and looped its way through the forest, and, in order to master it, the little witcher would take far longer than she would, following the shortcut. However, she could not loiter either. Beyond the gullet, the trail turned into the woods and led straight to the fortress. If she did not catch the boy at the precipice, she might not see him at all. She had already visited Caer Morhen a few times, and knew she saw only what the witchers wanted her to see. Triss was not so naive as to be unaware that they wanted to show her only a tiny fraction of the things to be seen in Caer Morhen. After a few minutes riding along the stony trough of the stream, she caught sight of the gullet. A leap over the gully, created by two huge mossy rocks, overgrown with gnarled, stunted trees. She released the reins. The horse snorted and lowered its head towards the water, trickling between pebbles. She did not have to wait long. The witcher's silhouette appeared on the rock, and the boy jumped, not slowing his pace. The magician heard the soft smack of his landing, and a moment later, a rattle of stones, the dull thud of a fall, and a quiet cry, or rather, a squeal. Triss instantly leapt from her saddle, threw the fur off her shoulders, and dashed across the mountainside, pulling herself up using tree branches and roots. Momentum aided her climb until she slipped on the conifer needles and fell to her knees next to a figure huddled on the stones. The youngster, on seeing her, jumped up like a spring, backed away in a flash, and nimbly grabbed the sword slung across his back, then tripped and collapsed between the junipers and pines. The magician did not rise from her knees. She stared at the boy and opened her mouth in surprise. Because it was not a boy. From beneath an ash-blonde fringe, poorly and unevenly cut, enormous emerald eyes, the predominant features in a small face with a narrow chin and upturned nose, stared out at her. There was fear in the eyes.
"Don't be afraid," Triss said tentatively.
The girl opened her eyes even wider. She was hardly out of breath and did not appear to be sweating. It was clear she had already run the killer more than once.
"Nothing's happened to you?"
The girl did not reply. Instead, she sprang up, hissed with pain, shifted her weight to her left leg, bent over and rubbed her knee. She was dressed in a sort of leather suit, sewn together, or rather stuck together, in a way which would make any tailor who took pride in his craft howl in horror and despair. The only pieces of her equipment which seemed to be relatively new and fitted her were her knee-high boots, her belts and her sword, but more precisely, her little sword.
"Don't be afraid," repeated Triss, still not rising from her knees. "I heard your fall and was scared. That's why I rushed here. I slept," murmured the girl. "Have you hurt yourself?" "No. You?"
The enchantress laughed, tried to get up, winced and swore at the pain in her ankle. She sat down and carefully straightened her foot, swearing once more.
"Come here, little one. Help me get up. I'm not little." "If you say so. In that case, what are you?" "A witcher."
"Ha! So come here and help me get up, witcher." The girl did not move from the spot. She shifted her weight from foot to foot, and her hands in their fingerless woolen gloves toyed with her sword belt as she glanced suspiciously at Triss.
"Have no fear," said the enchantress with a smile. "I'm not a bandit or outsider. I'm called Triss Merigold, and I'm going to Caer Morhen. The witchers know me. Don't gape at me. I respect your suspicion, but be reasonable. Would I have got this far if I hadn't known the way? Have you ever met a human on the trail?"
The girl overcame her hesitation, approached and stretched out her hand. Triss stood with only a little assistance, because she was not concerned with having help. She wanted a closer look at the girl, and to touch her. The green eyes of the little witcher girl betrayed no signs of mutation, and the touch of her little hand did not produce the slight, pleasant tingling sensation so characteristic of witches. Although she ran the killer path with a sword slung across her back, the ashen-haired girl had not been subjected to the trial of grasses or to changes. Of that, Triss was certain.
"Show me your knee, little one. I'm not little." "Sorry, but surely you have a name." "I do. I'm Ciri." "It's a pleasure. A bit closer, if you please, Ciri." "It's nothing. I want to see what nothing looks like." "Ah, that's what I thought. Nothing looks remarkably like torn trousers and skin grazed down to raw flesh. Stand still, and don't be scared." "I'm not scared. Ow!"
The magician laughed and rubbed her palm, itching from casting the spell against her hip. The girl bent over and gazed at her knee.
"Oh," she said. "It doesn't hurt anymore, and there's no hole. Was that magic?"
"You've guessed it."
"Are you a witch?"
"Guessed again, although I prefer to be called an enchantress. To avoid getting it wrong, you can call me by my name. Triss. Just Triss. Come on, Ciri. My horse is waiting at the bottom. We'll go to Caer Morhen together."
"I ought to run."
Ciri shook her head.
"It's not good to stop running, because you get milk in your muscles. Geralt says... Geralt is at the keep."
Ciri frowned, pinched her lips together, and shot a glance at the enchantress from beneath her ashen fringe. Triss chuckled again.
"All right," she said. "I won't ask. A secret's a secret, and you're right not to disclose it to someone you hardly know. Come on. When we get there, we'll see who's at the castle and who isn't. And don't worry about your muscles. I know what to do about lactic acid. Ah, here's my mount. I'll help you."
She stretched out her hand, but Ciri didn't need any help. She jumped agilely into the saddle, lightly, almost without taking off. The gelding started, surprised, and stamped, but the girl quickly took up the reins and reassured it.
You know how to handle a horse, I see.
I can handle anything.
Move up towards the pommel. Triss slipped her foot into the stirrup and caught hold of the mane.
Make a bit of room for me, and don't poke my eye out with that sword.
The gelding, spurred on by her heels, moved off along the stream bed at a walking pace. They rode across another gully and climbed the rounded mountainside. From there, they could see the ruins of Caer Morhen, huddled against the stone precipices. The partially demolished trapezium of the defensive wall, the remains of the barbican and gate, the thick, blunt column of the donjon. The gelding snorted and jerked its head, crossing what remained of the bridge over the moat. Triss tugged at the reins. The decaying skulls and skeletons strewn across the riverbed made no impression on her. She had seen them before.
I don't like this, the girl suddenly remarked. It's not as it should be. The dead should be buried in the ground, under a barrow, shouldn't they?
They should, the magician agreed calmly. I think so too. But the witches treat this graveyard as a reminder.
Reminder of what?
Caer Morhen, Triss said, as she guided the horse towards the shattered arcades, was assaulted.
There was a bloody battle here, in which almost all the witches died. Only those who weren't in the keep at the time survived.
Who attacked them? And why?
I don't know, she lied. It was a terribly long time ago, Ciri. Ask the witches about it.
I have, grunted the girl, but they didn't want to tell me.
I can understand that, thought the magician. A child trying to be a witcher, a girl at that, who has not undergone the mutations, should not be told such things. A child like that should not hear about the massacre. A child like that should not be terrified by the prospect that they too may one day hear words describing it like those which were screamed by the fanatics who marched on Caer Morhen long ago. Mutant, monster, freak, damned by the gods, a creature contrary to nature. No, I do not blame the witches for not telling you about it, little Ciri, and I shan't tell you either. I have even more reason to be silent, because I am a wizard, and without the aid of wizards, those fanatics would never have conquered the castle, and that hideous lampoon, that widely distributed monstrum which stirred the fanatics up and drove them to such wickedness was also, apparently, some wizard's anonymous work. But I, little Ciri, do not recognize collective responsibility. I do not feel the need to expiate the events which took place half a century before my birth. And the skeletons, which are meant to serve as an eternal reminder, will ultimately rot away completely, disintegrate into dust and be forgotten, will disappear with the wind, which constantly whips the mountainside.
They don't want to lie like that, said Ciri suddenly. They don't want to be a symbol. A bad conscience or a warning. But neither do they want their dust to be swept away by the wind.
Triss raised her head, hearing a change in the girl's voice. Immediately she sensed a magical aura, a pulsating and a rush of blood in her temples. She grew tense but did not utter a word, afraid of breaking into or disrupting what was happening.
An ordinary barrow.
Ciri's voice was becoming more and more unnatural. Metallic, cold and menacing.
A mound of earth, which will be overgrown with nettles. Death has cold blue eyes, and the height of the obelisk does not matter, nor does the writing engraved on it matter. Who can know that better than you, Triss Merigold, the 14th one of the hill?
The enchantress froze. She saw the girl's hands clench the horse's mane.
You died on the hill, Triss Merigold.
The strange, evil voice spoke again.
Why have you come here? Go back. Go back at once and take this child, the child of Elder Blood, with you. Return her to those to whom she belongs. Do this, 14th one. Because if you do not, you will die once more. The day will come when the hill will claim you. The mass grave, and the obelisk on which your name is engraved will claim you.
The gelding neighed loudly, tossing its head. Ciri jerked suddenly, shuddered.
What happened?
Asked Triss, trying to control her voice. Ciri coughed, passed both hands through her hair, and rubbed her face.
Nothing,
she muttered hesitantly.
I'm tired. That's why I fell asleep. I ought to run.
The magical aura disappeared. Triss experienced a sudden cold wave sweep through her entire body. She tried to convince herself it was the effect of the defensive spell dying away, but she knew that wasn't true. She glanced up at the stone blocks of the castle, the black, empty eye sockets of its ruined loopholes gaping at her. A shudder ran through her. The horse's shoes rang against the slabs in the courtyard. The magician quickly leapt from the saddle and held out her hand to Ciri. Taking advantage of the touch of their hands, she carefully emitted a magical impulse, and was astounded, because she didn't feel anything, no reaction, no reply, and no resistance. In the girl, who had, just a moment ago, manifested an exceptionally strong aura, there was not a trace of magic. She was now an ordinary, badly dressed child whose hair had been incompetently cut. But a moment ago, this child had been no ordinary child. Triss did not have time to ponder the strange event. The grate of an ironclad door reached her, coming from the dark void of the corridor, which gaped behind the battered portal. She slipped the fur cape from her shoulders, removed her fox fur hat, and, with a swift movement of the head, tousled her hair. Long, full locks the colour of fresh chestnuts, with a sheen of gold, her pride and identifying characteristic. Ciri sighed with admiration. Triss smiled, pleased by the effect she'd had. Beautiful, long, loose hair was a rarity, an indication of a woman's position, her status, the sign of a free woman, a woman who belonged to herself. The sign of an unusual woman, because normal maidens wore their hair in plaits. Normal married women hid theirs beneath a caul or a coif. Women of high birth, including queens, curled their hair and styled it. Warriors cut it short. Only druids and magicians, and whores, wore their hair naturally so as to emphasize their independence and freedom. The witches appeared unexpectedly and silently, as usual, and also as usual from nowhere. They stood before her, tall, slim, their arms crossed, the weight of their bodies on their left legs, a position from which she knew they could attack in a split second. Ciri stood next to them, in an identical position. In her ludicrous clothes, she looked very funny.
Welcome to Caer Morhen, Triss.
Greetings, Geralt.
He had changed. He gave the impression of having aged. Triss knew that, biologically, this was impossible. Witchers aged, certainly, but too slowly for an ordinary mortal or a magician as young as her to notice the changes. But one glance was enough for her to realize that although mutation could hold back the physical process of aging, it did not alter the mental. Geralt's face, slashed by wrinkles, was the best evidence of this. With a sense of deep sorrow, Triss tore her gaze away from the white-haired witcher's eyes, eyes which had evidently seen too much. What's more, she saw nothing of what she had expected in those eyes.
Welcome, he repeated. We are glad you've come.
Eskil stood next to Geralt, resembling the wolf like a brother, apart from the colour of his hair and the long scar which disfigured his cheek. And the youngest of the Caer Morhen witches, Lambert, was there, with his usual ugly, mocking expression. Vesemir was not there.
Welcome, and come in, said Eskil. It is as cold and blustery as if someone has hung themselves. Ciri, where are you off to? The invitation does not apply to you. The sun is still high. Even if it is obscured, you can still train.
Hey! The enchantress tossed her hair. Politeness comes cheap in witches' keep now, I see. Ciri was the first to greet me and brought me to the castle. She ought to keep me company.
She is undergoing training here, Merigold.
Lambert grimaced in a parody of a smile. He always called her that, Merigold, without giving her a title or a name. Triss hated it. She is a student, not a majordomo. Welcoming guests, even such pleasant ones as yourself, is not one of her duties. We're off, Ciri. Triss gave a little shrug, pretending not to see Geralt and Eskil's embarrassed expressions. She did not say anything, not wanting to embarrass them further. And, above all, she did not want them to see how very intrigued and fascinated she was by the girl.
I'll take your horse, offered Geralt, reaching for the reins.
Triss surreptitiously shifted her hand, and their palms joined. So did their eyes. I'll come with you, she said naturally. There are a few little things in the saddlebags which I'll need.
You gave me a very disagreeable experience not so long ago, he muttered, as soon as they had entered the stable. I studied your impressive tombstone with my own eyes. The obelisk in memory of your heroic death at the Battle of Sodden. The news that it was a mistake only reached me recently. I can't understand how anyone could mistake anyone else for you, Triss.
It's a long story, she answered. I'll tell you sometime, and please forgive me for the disagreeable moment.
There's nothing to forgive. I've not had many reasons to be happy of late, and the feelings I experienced on hearing that you lived cannot compare to any other, except perhaps what I feel now when I look at you.
Triss felt something explode inside her. Her fear of meeting the white-haired witcher, which had accompanied her throughout her journey, had struggled within her with her hope of having such a meeting, followed by the sight of that tired, jaded face, those sick eyes which saw everything, cold and calculating, which were unnaturally calm, but yet so infused with emotion. She threw her arms around his neck, instantly, without thinking. She caught hold of his hand, abruptly placed it on the nape of her neck, under her hair. A tingling ran down her back, penetrated her with such rapture she almost cried out. In order to muffle and restrain the cry, her lips found his lips and stuck to them. She trembled, pressing hard against him, her excitement building and increasing, forgetting herself more and more. Geralt did not forget himself.
Triss, please.
Oh, Geralt, so much...
Triss!
He moved her away delicately.
We're not alone. They're coming.
She glanced at the entrance and saw the shadows of the approaching witches only after some time, heard their steps even later. Oh well, her hearing, which she considered very sensitive, could not compete with that of a witcher.
Triss, my child.
Vesemir. Vesemir was really very old. Who knows, he could be even older than Caer Morhen. But he walked towards her with a brisk, energetic and sprightly step. His grip was vigorous, and his hands strong. I am happy to see you again, grandfather.
Give me a kiss. No, not on the hand, little sorceress. You can kiss my hand when I'm resting on my bier, which will no doubt be soon. Oh, Triss, it is a good thing you have come. Who can cure me if not you?
Cure you? Of what? Of behaving like a child, surely. Take your hand from my backside, old man, or I'll set fire to that grey beard of yours.
Forgive me. I keep forgetting you are grown up, and I can no longer put you on my knee and pat you. As to my health... Oh, Triss, old age is no joke. My bones ache, so I want to howl. Will you help an old man, child?
I will. The Enchantress freed herself from his bear-like embrace, and cast her eye over the witcher accompanying Vesemir. He was young, apparently the same age as Lambert, and wore a short black beard, which did not hide the severe disfigurement left behind by smallpox. This was unusual. Witchers were generally highly immune to infectious diseases.
Triss Merigold, Corwin.
Geralt introduced them to each other.
This is Corwin's first winter with us. He comes from the north, from Porvis.
The young witcher bowed. He had unusually pale yellow-green irises, and the whites of his eyes, riddled with red threads, indicated difficult and troublesome processes during his mutation.
"Let us go, child," uttered Vesemir, taking her by the arm. "The stable is no place to welcome a guest, but I couldn't wait to see you."
In the courtyard, in a recess in the wall sheltered from the wind, Ciri was training under Lambert's instructions. Deftly balancing on a beam hanging on chains, she was attacking, with her sword, a leather sack bound with straps to make it resemble a human torso. Triss stopped to watch.
"Wrong!" yelled Lambert,
You're getting too close. Don't hack blindly at it. I told you, the very tip of the sword at the carotid artery. Where does a humanoid have its carotid artery? On top of its head? What's happening? Concentrate, princess.
Huh? Thought Triss. So it is truth, not a legend. She is the one. I guessed correctly.
She decided to attack without delay, not allowing the witches to try any ruses.
The famous child surprise, she said, indicating Ciri. I see you have applied yourselves to fulfilling the demands of fate and destiny. But it seems you have muddled the stories, boys. In the fairy tales I was told, shepherdesses and orphans become princesses. But here, I see a princess is becoming a witcher. Does that not appear somewhat daring to you?
Vesemir glanced at Geralt. The white-haired witcher remained silent, his face perfectly still. He did not react, with even the slightest quiver of his eyelids, to Vesemir's unspoken request for support.
It's not what you think.
The old man cleared his throat.
Geralt brought her here last autumn. She has no one apart from... Triss, how can one not believe in destiny when...
What has destiny to do with waving a sword around?
We are teaching it a fence,
Geralt said quietly, turning towards her and looking her straight in the eyes.
What else are we to teach her? We know nothing else. Destiny or no, Kaer Morhen is now her home, at least for a while. Training and swordsmanship amuse her, keep her healthy and fit. They allow her to forget the tragedy she has lived through. This is her home now, Triss. She has no other.
Masses of Sintrians, the Enchantress said, holding his gaze, fled to Verden after the defeat, to Brugge, to Meria, and the islands of Skellige. Amongst them are magnates, barons, knights, friends, relations, as well as this girl's subjects.
Friends and relations did not look for her after the war. They did not find her.
Because she was not destined for them?
She smiled at him, not very sincerely, but very prettily as she could. She did not want him to use that tone of voice. The witcher shrugged. Triss, knowing him a little, immediately changed tactics and gave up the argument. She looked at Ciri again. The girl, agilely stepping along the balance beam, executed a half turn, cut lightly, and immediately leapt away. The dummy struck, swayed on its rope.
Well, at last, shouted Lambert. You finally got it. Go back and do it again. Want to make sure it wasn't a fluke.
The sword. Triss turned to the witches. Looks sharp. The beam looks slippery and unstable, and Lambert looks like an idiot, demoralizing the girl with all his shouting. Aren't you afraid of an unfortunate accident? Or maybe you're relying on destiny to protect the child against it?
Ciri practiced for nearly 6 months without a sword, said Cohen. She knows how to move, and we're keeping an eye on her because...
Because this is her home,
finished Geralt quietly but firmly. Very firmly. Using a tone which put an end to the discussion.
Exactly, it is.
Vesemir took a deep breath.
Triss, you must be tired and hungry.
I cannot deny it, she sighed, giving up on trying to catch Geralt's eye. To be honest, I'm on my last legs. I spent last night on the trail in a shepherd's hut, which was practically falling apart, buried in straw and sawdust. I used spells to insulate the shack. If it weren't for that, I would probably be dead. I long for clean linen.
You will have supper with us now, and then you will sleep as long as you wish and rest. We have prepared the best room for you, the one in the tower, and we have put the best bed we could find in Kaer Morhen there.
Thank you.
Triss smiled faintly.
In the tower, she thought. All right, Vesemir. Let it be the tower for today, if appearances matter so much to you. I can sleep in the tower in the best of all the beds in Kaer Morhen, although I would prefer to sleep with Geralt in the worst.
Let's go, Triss.
Let's go.
The wind hammered against the shutters and ruffled the remains of the moth-eaten tapestries, which had been used to insulate the window. Triss lay in perfect darkness, in the best bed in the whole of Kaer Morhen. She couldn't sleep, and not because the best bed in Kaer Morhen was a dilapidated antique. Triss was thinking hard, and all the thoughts chasing sleep away revolved around one fundamental question. What had she been summoned to the fortress for? Who had summoned her? Why?
For what purpose? Vesemir's illness was just a pretext. Vesemir was a witcher. The fact that he was also an old man did not change the fact that many a youngster could envy